Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. If I can ask you all to turn off your mobile phones, be grateful, because this is being podcast. And I'll introduce our speaker. Lee Sales has been in the audience before and on occasions reporting events at the Sydney Institute, but on this occasion she's performing at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the launch of, or the recent launch of, detainee 002, the case of David Hicks. And Glee Books has got some copies of Lee Sales' book, and I'm sure if you wanted to purchase one, I'm sure Lee would be happy to sign it for you. But I'll introduce her briefly. Lee Sales is the ABC's national security correspondent. She visited Guantanamo Bay twice during her recent four-year posting as the ABC TV Washington's correspondent. And in 2005, she won a prestigious Walkley Award for her coverage of the Guantanamo military commissions. And she was nominated again in 2006 for her coverage of Hurricane Katrina. But tonight she's going to talk about the case of David Hicks. Welcome.
Hello everyone, and thank you very much to Jared and Anne for having me. I had a bit of a reality check today because the publisher sent me through the sales data on all books around Australia, and while my book's selling pretty well, I couldn't help but notice that it is trailing the Spider-Man colouring book and the Brisbane Street Directory. It's ahead of the Perth Street Directory though, so I take a bit of heart from that. It's obviously very timely to be talking about David Hicks and the bigger picture surrounding his case given his arrival home a week ago. I was actually in the office of his lawyer, David McLeod, the following day, and David brought out a copy of the book for me to sign for him and said to me, look, you might be interested to know that this is the copy that David Hicks was reading on the plane on the way home. McLeod pointed to a bookmark and said, there's where he's up to. He was about halfway through. And I said to McLeod, oh, did he hate it, knowing that it's not very flattering of him? And McLeod said, no, he found it quite interesting, actually, to learn all about what had been going on outside Guantanamo while he'd been there. It must be quite an odd feeling, I imagine, to be reading about yourself in such a fashion, and I actually was quite surprised that Hicks felt reasonably positive about the material. As Jared noted in a recent column, Hicks seems to be behaving quite sensibly at the moment, in contrast to his past behaviour. He's pledging not to tell his story, promising to be a model prisoner, apologising to Australians, and vowing to get on with his life and be a responsible member of society. It'll be fascinating to see if that attitude can hold up once the media checkbooks come out as his release from prison draws closer. Tonight I'd like to do three things. The first is to tell you what I hope to achieve by writing this book and how I set about writing it in response to what I consider to be an immature debate surrounding the Hicks issue. The second is to debunk some of the myths surrounding the case of David Hicks. And the third is to put it all in some context and ask how the policy surrounding Guantanamo Bay and the handling of the Hicks case measure up against the goals of the war on terror. David Hicks and I found ourselves in American hands at around the same time in December 2001. US Immigration was stamping my visa for posting as the ABC's Washington correspondent, just as the US military was taking custody of Hicks in Afghanistan. Although I've reported on Guantanamo Bay since Hicks's arrival in January 2002, my deep interest began in 2004 after two trips to the prison. My first visit was on a media tour organised by the Pentagon, and the second was to cover the first military commission in 2004 at which Hicks appeared. When he walked into the hearing room, Hicks became a real person, not just a name in the newspaper. But I have always been more fascinated by the bigger picture questions that Hicks's case raises than in Hicks himself as an individual, and that's reflected in the book. I went to Guantanamo hoping to form a first-hand opinion about whether the prison really was a necessary part of the war on terror. By the time I arrived, the place was already highly controversial, and allegations of the abuse and mistreatment of prisoners were widely reported. As I walked through the various detention camps under military escort in the searing heat, the men in their orange jumpsuits behind the razor wire made me uncomfortable. My discomfort was prompted both by the possibility that I was looking at murderous extremists who'd helped plot September 11, and by the possibility that perhaps I wasn't. I couldn't know for sure because nobody had produced any evidence against them. During my visit, rather than being given any evidence that their extraordinary detentions were justified, I was simply asked by the military to trust and believe. That was impossible for a journalist. The indefinite nature of the incarceration and the suspension of regular legal rights were too much of a departure from traditional legal values for me to accept without question. But at the same time, my own eyes and ears led me to believe that Guantanamo wasn't as barbaric as it was made out to be either. None of the detainees came running to the wire, begging me to help them get out. Some laughed and kicked a soccer ball around and seemed very at ease. Not every soldier was a monster. Those I met were sincere and thoughtful. Some of them backed Bush, some of them didn't. Some of them supported Guantanamo Bay, some of them didn't. I just couldn't believe that when I wasn't there, they all beat and tortured the prisoners, or that every single one of them was part of a wholesale cover-up. So I left Guantanamo Bay believing the issues were more nuanced and less black and white than the public believed. My experiences in Washington contributed to that view. During more than 5 years, I met many of the Bush administration officials involved in detainee policy. I spent hours talking to them, trying to understand their perspective. I don't believe that they're all evil and calculating, as members of the Bush administration are often portrayed. That's not to justify some of the mistakes they've made or excuse their miscalculations. But many of them are decent people who sincerely believed they had to come up with a new way of battling terrorism after September 11. Some of them even disagreed with the detail of the administration's policy and fought hard from within for better processes and rights for the detainees. They chose to work within the Bush administration rather than go public to exert whatever influence they could. To my mind, the polarisation of the debate surrounding David Hicks has been unconstructive. It was hijacked by two conventional versions of the story. Either Hicks is a terrorist, so who cares what happens to him, or Hicks is a lost soul caught in the wrong place at the wrong time, a victim of the evil Bush administration. Like so many things, the truth and the reality is somewhere in the middle, and I felt that I had developed unique access to people involved in the story on all sides and with all the different views that would allow me to tell it in a more constructive and truthful fashion. As a journalist, I was drawn to the saga of David Hicks because, quite simply, it was a cracking good story. It included an island full of accused terrorists, secret meetings in the White House and Pentagon, an Australian youth who embraced militant Islam and then eventually took the President of the United States to court, an earnest Marine who became his greatest advocate, and an Ocker father who loved him in spite of everything. Sometimes when I found myself in Guantanamo Bay or at the Pentagon or walking past the White House, I had to remind myself that it wasn't a dream or a movie. I see my job as a journalist in very simple terms. My job's to tell people the facts, to offer analysis based on the facts, and to keep my own personal views, politics and opinions out of my reporting as much as I can. I was interested to note in the first two reviews of the book, both done by lawyers with strong opinions of the Hicks case, they criticised me for being obsessed with balance and pragmatism and annoyingly fair. They meant it as a criticism, but as a journalist I took it as a compliment, and my boss said to me, well, what do they mean annoyingly fair, as opposed to what, pleasantly prejudiced? The reviewers were annoyed that I'd written a piece of journalism rather than a polemic that backed a particular side, in their case the side that the Bush administration and the Howard government were morally wrong. But their comments told me that I had achieved what I hoped when I set out to write this book. I wanted to write the most clinical, balanced account I could of the Hicks saga and assess it objectively on the basis of facts and results, not emotion, politics or morality. I don't have any problem with opinion journalism or editorials when they're declared as such, But I do have a problem with a couple of recent trends that I think are undermining the centrality of objectivity in journalism. One is the so-called rise of niche news, which is news that panders to the bias of its audience by unashamedly coming from a particular ideological position. The other is advocacy journalism, which is a term I first came across at a seminar organised by the New Yorker magazine. Call me crazy, but I always thought if you were an advocate, then you gave up the right to call yourself a journalist. I know that by discussing objectivity, I'm inviting zealots on both the left and right to trawl through my book listing examples of bias, and I'm quite sure they'll find them on both sides. We all fail because we're human beings, and I do accept that pure objectivity is impossible to achieve because we all bring our subconscious biases to our reporting. But I think it's critical that we don't stop striving for objectivity because there's such enormous power in it. Surely, if a reader can see the facts laid out bare and stark and clear, then the conclusions based on those facts are far more compelling than if there's an obvious agenda in place from the first page. So that's really what I tried to do very hard with the book. My central question was to ask, have the Guantanamo policy and the handling of David Hicks served the goals of the war on terror, to reduce terrorism and to mete out swift justice to terrorists? The answer is no, and I'll explain why later in my talk. This book is not going to win fans among either sides of the debate because it supports neither. It comes down in the middle, finding both sides have flaws in their arguments. Let me give you some examples by debunking some of the myths that have surrounded the case of David Hicks. Myth number one, the Australian government abandoned Hicks. That is patently untrue. The Prime Minister certainly did make a decision early on that Hicks should be left in the hands of the Americans. And it's important to understand that decision in the context at the time. September 11 was very recent. Everybody was extremely uncertain about terrorism and fearing another attack, potentially a worse one at any moment. David Hicks was the sort of person who could have been the worst nightmare of Australia's security agencies. He was white, Western, no criminal record, he was not on any sort of watch list, he had no known links to Islamic extremists. If he'd wanted to commit an act of terrorism in Australia, he would have been able to plan it almost certainly undetected. From late 2002, the Australian Embassy in Washington, having implemented the Prime Minister's decision to leave Hicks with the Americans, became anxious that there hadn't been any forward progress in the Hicks case. By mid-2003, the Ambassador, Michael Thorley, was extremely anxious. The Justice Minister at the time, Chris Ellison, came to Washington and met with Pentagon officials, and they made a deal about the military commissions and worked out a system that was workable for both sides. Thorley then told the embassy to pressure the Pentagon as much as they could to get a trial for Hicks happening as soon as possible, along with one for the other Australian at Guantanamo Bay, Mamdouh Habib. But the Australians were extremely frustrated in this quest. They simply could not get answers out of the Pentagon, and there was a total lack of transparency at that end about what was going on. In desperation, the embassy staff went to their friends in the State Department and at the National Security Council to ask them to press the Pentagon on Australia's behalf. But the American officials, right up to Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, couldn't get answers either. The Pentagon was basically a law unto itself during that period, partly because it had the strong backing of the Vice President's office. It took until mid-2004 and constant lobbying by the Australian government, 2.5 years after Hicks was first detained, for the Pentagon to press charges and attempt to hold a hearing. But by that stage, unfortunately, there had been so much mucking around and delay that the defence lawyers for the detainees had been able to mount civilian court action, and then that paved the way for several more years of delay after that. All through that period, the Australian diplomats in Washington were constantly badgering the Pentagon to hurry up and sort Hicks out, and they were very anxious about the delays. So whatever one thinks of the Howard government's original policy to leave Hicks to the US and whether that was morally right or wrong, or whatever one thinks of their decision to stick by that, and I think there is an argument that they stuck by it beyond the point of utility, the allegation that Hicks was abandoned is demonstrably false. Myth number two, Hicks was tortured at Guantanamo Bay. This is also incorrect, and there's a very simple explanation why. Interrogators at Guantanamo Bay never had to use any harsh interrogation techniques on Hicks because he sang like a canary from the first day he was captured. As one Australian source told me, Hicks talked to the whole lot of them, the FBI, the CIA, the AFP, MI5, anybody who showed up with a hamburger, he'd tell them anything they wanted to know. One of the American military prosecutors familiar with the Hicks case described him to me as a man of no personal courage or intellect. He told us everything from the first day of his capture. We never had to use any techniques at all, Honey McGuantanamo. There was no need. Hicks never faced some of the questionable techniques which have caused the Bush administration so much grief. The dogs, the strobe lights, the sleep deprivation, the loud music and so on. Certainly other prisoners at Guantanamo did. Hicks did not. Myth number three, Hicks was not abused while in US custody. You'll notice that I'm drawing a distinction between torture and abuse. Hicks was not tortured. That does not mean he was not abused. The extent of his physical abuse is unclear because there are different accounts, and it seems that lawyers have not been, and I certainly have not been able to uncover any independent witnesses who can corroborate from one side or the other. Officials on both the pro and anti-Hicks side have told me there is evidence to support some what they called rough handling of Hicks in Afghanistan in the 1 month period when he was held there before his transfer to Guantanamo Bay. Hicks in court documents has alleged he was roughed up, questioned at rifle point, things of this nature. There is some credence to that, but we're not talking about severe physical abuse such as waterboarding or sustained beatings. Hicks certainly was mentally and emotionally abused. It is a fact that he was held at Guantanamo Bay for long periods in solitary confinement, which experts believe is a form of mental abuse. I've been in one of the cells in which he was held, and it would be unimaginable to spend any time in there, let alone the 16 months Hicks spent in there. The Red Cross also believes the open-ended nature of the detention at Guantanamo Bay is a form of mental duress. On its visits to Guantanamo, the Red Cross found a high incidence of mental health issues among the detainees because they were held with no end in sight, which led, in the Red Cross's words, to a pervasive sense of hopelessness in the camp. There are also anecdotal tales of petty mistreatment of Hicks, which come from his camp. One is that anything to do with love, the love of his family, was deleted from letters from home to him in Guantanamo Bay. This does ring true because it fits with the philosophy of Guantanamo, which was to mentally break down the detainees as much as possible so they would be vulnerable to interrogation. Another story which I heard from several sources is that Hicks received a phone call from his family in August last year and was told by the guard who took him to take the call to pack up all of his possessions, which led Hicks to believe that this was finally the call to tell him that he was going home. When Hicks got to the phone, he was very excited and expectant, and then there was a lot of confusion. The family finally made it clear that it was just a routine call. And according to them, Hicks was absolutely gutted and could barely speak for 20 minutes because he was utterly crushed with disappointment. And there are other examples of issues like that. Pet guards at Guantanamo not taking Hicks's complaints seriously about things like a sore tooth. Sources in Washington told me that Hicks got a reputation at Guantanamo Bay for being a hypochondriac because he complained all the time. And the embassy official who had access to Hicks believed it was because there was no other stimulus for him, so anything that for any of us would be fairly minor, like a sore back or a sore tooth or whatever, became his whole world because that was all there was, and so it got him a bit of a bad reputation at Guantanamo as a whinger. Myth number four, the war on terror is a war. The war on terror is not a war in the traditional sense of what we understand a war to be. In 2001, few people asked how the USA's war on terror fit the accepted definition of war. But in the field of international relations, war is traditionally understood to be a conflict between two or more political units that takes place either internationally or within one nation's borders. There are many types of wars, including civil wars, limited wars, total wars, wars of secession, among others. To minimise the damage that wars do, the international community has devised a series of rules for their conduct, including the Geneva Conventions. These limit the types of targets and the use of certain weapons, as well as offer protections for civilians and rights for people captured on the battlefield. Governments or individuals violating these rules can be prosecuted for war crimes. The war on terror does not fit the standard definition. There's no clear enemy, since terror is a nebulous term. There's no acknowledgement of sovereignty, since terrorists can be pursued anywhere. There's no way to determine the end of hostilities. The rules of war themselves seem outdated because terrorists don't fight by them. As one official in the National Security Council at the time told me, there was no clarity right from the beginning as to the scope of what this war on terror might be. This imprecise definition proved problematic as the War on Terror unfolded and as the Bush administration had to invent rules as it went along with limited consultation. Without clear definition and clear parameters, the war led to indefinite detentions at Guantanamo Bay, harsh interrogations of prisoners, and an invasion of Iraq that fueled terrorism. But immediately after September 11, the sense of urgency and threat was so great that the most influential Bush administration policymakers largely ignored the difficulties of adapting the new conflict to a traditional war framework, and they tried to make it fit as best they could. We now realise, and our own Prime Minister has acknowledged, that the war on terror is more akin to the Cold War, a long-running ideological conflict that will occasionally flare up into limited hot wars like Iraq and Afghanistan. Myth number five, Hicks was a lost soul in the wrong place at the wrong time. That is not true. David Hicks made decision after decision to get more and more deeply involved with Islamic extremism and military and espionage training. We know this from his own admissions and his letters to his family. One of the most important pieces of evidence against Hicks, which would have been produced in his trial, was an interview he gave to the AFP in 2002 at Guantanamo Bay. This interview was recorded, and it's clear that he voluntarily cooperated. It was explained to him that he was not going to have a lawyer present and that that was not something that would be acceptable in Australia. And did he understand that, and did he accept it? And he said yes and cooperated in a great amount of detail. ASIO's view on Hicks was that it beggared belief that somebody could have written home about ending the Western Jewish domination and then studied bomb-making, marksmanship and spying techniques without drawing any connection. There is a question about whether Hicks was a lost soul looking for adventure or whether he was a committed believer. But really, if you steal a car, the "I was a lost soul looking for adventure" defence doesn't cut it. The action is what matters, and in the Hicks case, regardless of his motivation, there is no doubt that he trained with Al-Qaeda during 2001. That's not to say that he deserved 5 years at Guantanamo Bay without a day in court, but it's clear that he was no innocent either. Earlier on, I said that with this book, I began by posing the questions, have the Guantanamo policy and the handling of David Hicks, when you examine the results, served the goals of the war on terror, to mete out swift justice to terrorists and to reduce terrorism around the world? The answer is definitely no, and here's why. Firstly, on the issue of delivering swift justice, that was meant to be the goal of bypassing Congress and unilaterally setting up the military commissions to try terrorists just after September 11. Instead, after five chaotic years, only David Hicks has gone through that process. The other 385 detainees languish at Guantanamo Bay in limbo. Since September 11, the only successfully litigated terrorism prosecutions around the world have occurred in conventional courts, including the cases of John Walker Lind, Richard Reid, and Zacharias Moussaoui. This undermines the administration's argument that civilian courts are not up to the task of trying terrorists and that only military commissions can handle it. So far, the opposite has proven to be the case. I argue in the book that it is understandable that the administration went down that route after September 11 because, as I said, there was so much uncertainty and fear at the time. But the big problem was not revisiting and re-examining those decisions when the dust had settled and when there was time to actually consider, is this going to achieve the outcomes we want? It opened them to massive legal problems, as we've seen later down the line. Secondly, on the issue of reducing terrorism around the world, the Bush administration's failure to establish a legislative basis for its detainee policy was matched only by its neglect of public diplomacy. It never convinced the world that the Guantanamo detainees were such a significant threat that they had to be held beyond the rule of law. For years, the president was not prepared to even debate the USA's decisions in the war on terror. Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists, Bush announced on the 20th of September 2001. The administration's supporters dismissed anybody who disagreed with its policies and how it was implementing the war as weak on national security. But by failing to consider the effect that Guantanamo Bay would have on global opinion, the Bush administration inspired new recruits to Islamic extremism. According to some experts, Guantanamo now equals the Palestinian cause as a rallying call for Islamic fundamentalists. The Council for Global Terrorism, an informal international study group of seven leading terrorism experts, finds that Guantanamo is almost certainly accelerating mass Islamic radicalisation. The latest survey by the Pew Global Attitudes Project finds that the USA's image is declining in many parts of the world, particularly in Western Europe and predominantly Muslim countries. Outside the USA, only two countries continue to show majority support for the war on terror, India and Russia. The Pew survey says support has collapsed in Spain and Japan, two of the USA's closest allies in the initial phase of the war. At 30%, the United Kingdom has the highest level of public confidence in Bush's international leadership. The USA's closest Muslim ally, Turkey, has the lowest at a pitiful 3%. Although the war in Iraq is primarily responsible for America's image problem, Guantanamo Bay has contributed as well. Regardless of the USA's recent efforts to introduce more openness and accountability, Guantanamo has become shorthand for every mistake in the war on terror and for the USA's mistreatment of detainees. As Randy Shriver, the former Chief of Staff to Richard Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State, the former Deputy Secretary of State, told me, I think it's massively damaged the US image abroad. It's part of a broader story of Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, unilateralism, Iraq, and as President Bush acknowledged himself, the President's Texas style and rhetoric being too aggressive at times. We'll suffer the consequences for quite some time in terms of rebuilding trust. The administration realised too late that its closed, exclusive approach, even within its own administration, had created more problems than it had prevented. As another senior Bush administration official told me, currently serving in a top post in the administration, there's a saying, it's better to have people inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. That's what they ended up with. It's impossible to draw any direct link between the Bush administration's foreign policy and the number of terrorist attacks around the world. But if Guantanamo is part of an overall US strategy to reduce terrorism since September 11, then the strategy is failing. In 2003, the State Department calculated the number of global terrorist attacks worldwide to be 208. In 2004, that figure roughly tripled to 650. Following controversy about how those numbers were calculated, a newly created National Centre for Counterterrorism within the State Department took over responsibility for gathering the data. Using the expanded criteria, it adjusted the 2004 figure to 3,192 attacks. Then in 2005, using the same guidelines, there were reportedly 11,111 incidents. Despite the US-led war on terror, terrorism is unfortunately increasing, not decreasing. Thank you for your interest, and I'll hand back to Jerry.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.